I'm Charles Breton.
And I'm Chris Henson. And together we are
a Jew
and a Gentile.
Walk into a bar.
Mitzvah.
Wishing I could change the things that I screwed up. What am I supposed to do? I can't give up. You know I can't give up.
Welcome once again to A Jew and a Gentile Walk into a Bar Mitzvah, the podcast. I'm the Jew, Charles Breton, along with Chris Henson, the Gentile. And once again, we'll try to cover everything from the sarcastic to the profane.
Right.
And we're going to start by acknowledging our sponsors. We always lead off with Men of the Beard Beard Oil.
The only beard oil approved by both Christians and shaman.
Yes.
Which happens to be the same person, but...
Makes it much easier for both to approve.
Right.
Yeah. But also, Virgil Cane Whiskey. We're drinking mint juleps made with their ginger-infused bourbon.
I had a dram of the ginger-infused bourbon a couple nights ago. A $2 or $3 cigar, which I won't revisit. But the Virgil Cane, I mean, you could drink that like water. I mean, you probably shouldn't, but
you can.
It's so mild. It's so tasty. It's got all the goodness of bourbon, and it's just really mild on the palate. I mean, it's not... It doesn't have that burn that rye sometimes has, at least that I experienced with some ryes.
But not with Virgil Cane rye.
Virgil Cane, but you guys did good down there in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's very rare that people from North Carolina recognize you as being other than that state we passed through on the way to Florida. See, I didn't mention Georgia because I know you got issues with Georgia.
Yeah, I do.
But of all the juleps I've seen in front of me when we podcast, these are the best. See? Yeah. Anti-Semitic, and we're not even 4 minutes in.
Yeah. Well, this and it's fresh mint from my garden, and
we'll post pictures.
Yeah, oh, delicious.
And it's so. Sorry, I'm trying to do too many wonderful things at once because you also really hooked us up with cigars this week, or at least me. This may make up for any previous sins, but we'll hold that.
We'll hold that.
We're
done shamefully
plugging. Did we mention Virgil Cane? How awesome they are.
No, we should do that because they really are.
It's a damn fine whiskey.
It is a damn fine whiskey. And by the way, as a side note, we are officially podcasting at Wild Goose. So come by the GooseCast stage and not only meet a Jew and a Gentile, listen to us in person, but share some of the Virgil Cane we're going to be bringing.
We may have the shittiest podcast.
But we're going to great
But by God, we got great sponsors.
Yeah, we're going to be doing happy hour.
And you drink enough of this, which is easy to do.
We sound good.
We sound brilliant.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's why.
It's Churchill almost.
Yeah, I don't drink whiskey so I sound better. I drink whiskey so you sound better.
I usually do that so the missus looks better.
You went there.
She's not home this weekend. She's roller derby in Charleston.
All right. Well, speaking of alcohol, we also love Four Saints Brewing Company down in Asheboro. In about a week or two, they're celebrating their third anniversary.
I saw some advertising on that.
And then, of course, coming up, it'll be the first Sunday in May, and that means beer and hymns.
Right.
One of my favorite things.
Come for the alcohol, come for the hymns. It's a win-win.
Stay for the protests.
that was the saddest protest in the history of protests.
Sad protest, yeah.
I like beer, and I like hymns, but fuck it.
How dare you do them together?
Put them two together.
I'll have another beer, and you'll be fine.
Right.
Top Leaf Cigar Lounge, the official cigar lounge.
Now the name may change because we say it's the home away from home away from home. But now
you're no longer homeless.
Well, I wasn't homeless before.
You were houseless.
Houseless. I was in an apartment living. You know, but we put a down payment on a house and wife called me out to take a look at it, which basically means I'm buying this, but just out of courtesy.
Yeah.
No, she put a whole lot of research into it and... It's really close to our work. It's the school district my kid wants to attend, and so I show up, and she's like, "And you can smoke downstairs in the unfinished basement." So now this is you know it's a start.
That's huge.
I got it. There's a shitload of space down there. We could Who knows? We'll have our own speakeasy.
That's great.
The Jew and the Gentile, the speakeasy. So the home away from home away from home. I may have to add a fourth home to that.
Okay.
But not yet.
But the question,
even with it.
But the question is there in the backyard a shed so that you can have a bucket and a gasoline-soaked rack just in case you get locked out?
You want me to tell that story?
By all means. Four Saints Brewing Company. Four Saints pays homage to the patron saints of beer, St. Wenceslas, St. Nicholas, St. Luke, and St. Augustine of Hippo. They've become the most recognized patron saints for brewing and beer because of their contributions to and associations with the world's favorite sudsy beverage. Four Saints founders Joel McCloskey and Andrew Deming are carrying on the brewing tradition in hopes of future sainthood, or at least to make some really good beer. Four Saints Brewing Company, Asheboro, North Carolina.
You want to go ahead and plug the rest of the sponsors?
Well, that was it. Top Leaf Cigar Lounge.
That was me with Virgil Kane.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to be there. I'm going to be there tomorrow around 2 o'clock. Hang out with Honey Bear the Chaplain.
Mm-hmm.
That's her name. She picked it for her roller derby persona. I did not just call a colleague Honey Bear.
But if you could, you would call her
Mrs. Gentile.
Honey Bear.
No, yeah. Mrs. Gentile gets Honey Bear.
Oh, okay.
Which is really fun when you're working the same floor with her,
mm-hmm.
and she says something like, "Hey, Daddy," and you just kind of go, "Yeah, that's right." And watching the rest of the staff kind of creep out, going, "Oh, they're married." Mm-hmm. So the first parsonage I had in the U.S., we didn't have any furniture because we'd sold everything we had in our apartment while I was still finishing up at Duke, and so we bought new furniture. You know, we did the whole rooms to go, and I had to get it delivered. And I had this dog then, and God rest his soul, Jack. He was a Jack Russell terrorist. He legitimately was. He
and
was
what a clever name calling him.
He was
him
racist.
Jack.
When we got him in England, he wouldn't attack anybody. But if he saw somebody wearing like, you know, more traditional, you know, Near Eastern, Middle Eastern kind of type clothing, he was hell on burkas and just would go nuts. And he got me once. He bit me on the ass when I tried to leave the house wearing my preaching robe. He wasn't going to have that shit.
Well, it's not so much a racial thing. I just think he was an atheist.
Oh, I didn't look at that angle.
Yeah.
Well, he is British. They're post-Christian.
Yeah, it's true. So, anyways, we had this house.
So we had this house, and we were getting furniture delivered, and my dog's an asshole. So we didn't have a back porch to lock him up in. And so I just thought, you know what? I'm just going to close him out in the hallway and let the furniture folks move in the furniture without being molested by the fucking dog. And then, you know, once they were done, I'll open the door and, you know, we're good to go. So I'm out there basically in my boxers and a t-shirt letting them in. And I'm thinking like, you know, once they get this stuff moved in, I'm going to go back through the living room door. Well, it was hot that day and the door swole shut. So I couldn't get into the rest of the house. I'm like, oh, no problem. I figure we're in a very safe neighborhood. My wife literally couldn't possibly lock the door when she left for work since I was off that day. But lo and behold, she did. So I get out there after the furniture movers are gone. And I had this, you know, you've seen the scene in Dumb and Dumber where like it was not Jim Carrey's character. It's the other one.
Mm.
Just shits violently, you know, kind of like that 2 minutes. Looks like sounds like he's passing a can of V8 followed by 2 minutes of hot dog water. And it's just one of those power shits. I have that. That is what struck me. So I'm looking around the house in the yard to find, you know, something to shit behind. Because I'm not going to make it back into the house. I don't find... There's not a tree in that yard. There's not a bush. I have neighbors across the street that I know. And in retrospect, probably would have let me in. But I'd only been their minister maybe for a month. Maybe less than that. And the idea of me showing up in my underwear and a t-shirt going, I really need to shit in your house. So I think, okay, I'm going to the backyard. Maybe I can shit in the backyard. And it's like, fuck, there's even less trees back here. And I finally see the shed where we keep the lawnmower and all the yard shit. And now
any literally.
Port in a storm, right?
Yeah.
So I go in there and there's this 10-gallon bucket. And I'm like going, ha. And so I proceed to let loose with a shit that was, you know, you know, like Ron, what's his name? Ron White says, you know, you can fit into another pair of pants afterwards, shits. And so I do that. God, I can't believe I'm telling this on air. I do it.
Well, you edit.
I did. So, you know, you get done pooping. It's then when you look up to go, I have nothing to wipe my ass with. Which is one thing if you're in a house, you know, because then you got maybe a cloth. You know, you sacrifice a shower curtain, drapes, you know, whatever.
Wife's favorite indoor sweater.
Indoor, you know. Yeah, you know. classic shit cleaning stuff. So I look around and I see this the cloth, and I'm like going, ah, any port in a storm. And I go to wipe my ass with it. It is that point that I realize the guy that mows my lawn has been using it to clean gas off the lawnmower before he fires it up. So if you want to know what the maximum pucker factor is for a sphincter, you rub some, you get some 86 grade octane and you just, I tell you,
no ethanol.
Oh, I didn't shit for a week. Pure. I whistled when I farted there for a couple days. It was rough. What the hell were we talking about?
Well, we're getting into, talking eventually about
race. We're taking care of the profane.
And so, well, we're going to get back into grace, and I think
that, do we plug everybody that we need to plug?
Yeah,
Pipe and Pint?
Well, no, because we didn't plug you.
No, I so, not that day. It came out my nose.
No, we did Pipe and Pint.
We didn't do Pipe and Pint, did
we? Yes, we did Pipe and Pint.
One
on Spring Garden.
In Greensboro?
In Greensboro. I always do Pipe and Pint.
It's still there, though, right? I mean, because you guys
had still there.
Tornadoes and stuff this week.
It is still there. Well, the tornadoes were north and east of here. So we were good.
So if you'd have been in that cigar lounge, you'd have been safe. Yet another way cigars make life better.
Yeah, enclosed room. Would have locked the humidor.
Right. And what would you do to pass the time when the power went out? You're going to need
just
fire.
Just reading cigar boxes.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have to light something so I could read. So, yeah.
You don't want to waste the fuel. So
No.
Something
that definitely not. But also because if the power was out, that means the humidification system would have been out, and then
now,
all the cigars
back up on that fucker.
Well, but the cigars would have all gotten bad.
So we need to smoke.
So we need to smoke them
or take them home with us after the power
comes. To cure them.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of cigars, what are you smoking there?
Okay, so you sent me a text at work today, and all you sent was a picture of the LFD. It's not infamous. It's just awesome. The LFD Cabinet 5, which we've reviewed on the show before. Or at least I think I've smoked enough of them. But then they became really, really scarce.
That's because you smoked a lot of them.
Well, I had some help with that. And it turns out JD.
At Top Leaf.
JT, that's Justin Timberlake. I knew that wasn't right. JD's way cooler.
Much
cooler. And it happens to be JD's favorite cigar, which I think he'd shared that with us.
Yes, he has. So, but you don't pay attention to what anybody tells you.
I don't. But it just shows, yet again, the class and palate of the Top Leaf cigar folks. Mm-hmm. Even if we weren't, shamelessly plugging them, if you can get a hold of this stick, smoke it.
Yeah.
So, the LFD Cabinet 5, of course, it's, Flor Dominicana, Lito Gomez. I mean, Lito, I think you're telling me JD had to, basically browbeat Lito
He just kept on them until they sent him a box.
Right. So, it's a Toro Vitola. It's a 6x25 length and 52 ring gauge. So, a nice little good little cigar. Very dark, oily Maduro. It's so good. You didn't even need to put a band on it. It's just awesome. And it's a Connecticut broadleaf Maduro wrapper, which I was surprised. I forget that point of it because you don't think Connecticut and oomph.
Mm-hmm.
But it's Lito, so oomph. And it's the filler is Dominican, of course, with a bit of Nicaraguan. And the binder is also a Dominican, so it's a nice little mud of a blend there. Not a puro, but wonderfully wonderful. So tasting notes, obviously, with it being Lito and it having some Nicaraguan in it, you're going to get the earth, you're going to get the spice, leather notes, spice. We're talking pepper. There are citrus notes, and then it's the sugary bits. It's kind of a mixture of a molasses taste. And it's not quite dark chocolate. I can't tell if it's dark chocolate or more of a coffee.
But it's like a mocha. It is.
Doesn't have to be binaries. It could be both.
Exactly.
And so this had been one of my favorites. And after the Jew smoked the Hoya de Monterey Excalibur from the 90s.
Yeah.
The time capsule of the first cigar I truly enjoyed and became sort of my brand. This makes up for it. Well, that
I do what I can.
If you'd have bought me the box, I would have forgiven you for killing Jesus. So I mean, two anti-Semitic comments in less than a
wow.
What are you?
We are on a record here.
What is our record?
I don't know. We did the 52 fucks. I don't know how anti-Semitic we've gotten.
Is that really appropriate to make a drinking game though? And what would you drink?
Virgil Gaine. I do want to point out, and when you see what we've posted on our Twitter feed, but also on the show page, there's two mint juleps. There's one in a traditional mint julep glass, and then there's a shorty.
Yeah, I got more of a tumbler. You got that highball kind of looking thing there.
Yeah, I got the real deal here.
Not complaining. I mean,
hey, I would have made you the tall one, but
Well, I thought I had child tonight, but she's seen the light and gone to stay with a friend tonight.
Oh, good.
She didn't want to come smoke cigars with us.
Sometimes I question her her life choices. Right. You know, wanting to go to University of Georgia.
Well, she's not doing gymnastics now. She's all about tennis.
Ah.
And last night she had her band concert, which, you know, if you want to know what's just south of waterboarding, sixth grade spring band concert.
Ooh.
But she did play. She, of all the kids playing there, she was the most Vietnamese sounding.
Good.
Right.
Good.
Right. Yeah. One of four minorities in the entire band.
Probably the only four minority families in Davie County.
Right. Well, you know, when I'm here and summer's away, so there are no Democrat. Well, no, there's not, because I think Cigar Mom and Trucker Jeff are
AWOL. Yeah.
So what are you smoking?
So what am I smoking? Oh, I'm smoking. I'm literally smoking something special, because this is a cigar called Something Special. It comes from Felix Azzelin. And I have discovered him thanks to Bethany and JD at Top Leaf and Scott Hawks at Cigar Hawk.
Shameless plugs.
Shameless plugs.
Come on, Hawks. He's doing some
wonderful stuff. So, Nicaraguan Honduran filler, Indonesian binder, and then Habano Criollo 98 wrapper.
The wrapper is Criollo. Usually that's
Criollo 98.
That's a filler usually when I'm in my...
Yes.
Okay, now that's kinky.
Isn't it?
Well, I know this what I'm having. They still have some? Cause
oh, yeah.
I think 2 o'clock tomorrow I'm going
to... Oh, no, yeah. No, you have to pick up this cigar. The cold draw is incredible. The cold draw, you get, of course, the earthy barnyard, I call the fecund sweetness.
Love that word.
But then when you light it, you get these beautiful pepper notes, and that's followed by cedar and creamy. We were talking about it today and can't quite identify what is the sweetness in it, but it just, there is a sweetness to it. It's not a taste. You can't say, oh, well, you know, it's sweet like molasses or like cedar.
Is it more that organic tobacco, natural tobacco?
Not even that. It's this otherworldly... You know, it's not a flavor that you're tasting, but it's just an overall quality that just balances the pepper and the tobacco earthiness to it.
Right.
Beautiful. And then eventually, though, the pepper backs off, and then you do pick up some cocoa, but that's even not the sweetness in it.
Sounds more of a dark chocolate kind of cocoa.
Oh, yeah.
Not sickly sweet.
Beautiful stuff. And I've been... The whole line that Felix Azzelin has been coming out with has really been fantastic.
So
Ego Red and Black, Two Saints, the best of the Havana Sunrise. The other thing about this is a box straight from a manufacturer. When you open it up, these cigars have been sitting because the cellophane is already turning amber.
Ooh.
So
I'm noticing the box on the table. Did you go hog wild?
Well, I had recently. Well, this is an empty box now of their sampler.
You bought a sampler.
I bought a sampler a couple of weeks ago, so I could go through.
And it's now an empty box.
And I am a Azzelin fan.
If you're listening, Felix, we yet to have
an official cigar
podcast.
Bethany and Scott and I talked about it. We're gonna
you know,
work on it.
If we did, and we can pick the name of the cigar, I think we should name it this.
Okay.
That way we can just say, "Have you tried this?
Have you tried this cigar?"
And if they come out with a sequel, that.
Mm-hmm. Well, because then you have to smoke this
and that.
Absolutely.
Come on, that's as smart ass as our walk into a bar mitzvah.
Almost.
Did we get everybody? Did we get the cigar
in? We got the cigars in. So last week we were talking about Grace. We ignored her sisters, Joy and Hope.
I was adjusting my microphone and thinking about mint julep and cigar.
Yeah.
So you're going to have to repeat that.
I said we were talking about Grace and ignored her sisters, Joy and Hope.
Good night. Say good night, Gracie.
Say good night, Gracie. I wonder how many people got that reference on the picture.
Well, I didn't want, you know, you're looking for like
I thought it was brilliant.
A public image that you can use and like Grace. You see all this stuff that I associate with like really overproduced contemporary worship services.
Right.
And definitely a Christian standpoint on the subject. So I just went with, you know, okay, what Gracies do I know?
Yeah.
What Grace do I know? And I was like, you know, Grace Slick. I was like, yeah, you know.
And then I was the sexiest woman in rock and roll.
Yeah, at one time.
She did not age well, but she's still on my list. She's on the list as you know, in the top three.
That's filed away in the memory, right? It's
yeah,
rainy day kind of material. No, and I was like, oh well, you know, Grace Allen, and I was just like, oh, and lo and behold, she's with George Burns, and you know, George, other than I don't know, hell, he probably put one in his mouth when he was dead in his casket, but. You know, was very rarely seen without his cigar.
Yeah.
I can't remember what brand he smokes now, but it's one of the big, became one of the big brands, and I'm blanking on it.
I'm sure you'll figure it out.
I can't, you know, I am happy.
Mm-hmm.
I have mint julep with Virgil Caine, ginger bourbon, and I have a cabinet number 5.
Okay.
Either one of those.
So you're good.
You're good, yeah.
Okay.
Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey started with one goal, to create the best damn whiskey around. Drawing on their culinary know-how and driven by flavor, founders David and Ryan, both accomplished chefs, were inspired to boldly blend, infuse, and tinker with choice ingredients to craft category-shattering whiskeys, proving that it's not about stuffy tradition, but about taking what you know and taking chances. Each of their spirits is a tribute to their dedication to making whiskey their way, a whiskey they'd want to drink. Again, Virgil Caine Rye Whiskey, a damn fine whiskey.
So we were talking about Grace. We did that and talked about a lot of the differences between those concepts and Christianity and Judaism, especially because it doesn't exist in Judaism. So that's a big difference right there. But you had commented, though, that there were that in editing and listening, there were things that you wanted to revisit and clarify.
When we were recording, I remember some instances where I know you were analyzing it in the sense of, you know, well, you're saying philosophically and theologically, but you're saying this, this, and this, but it doesn't add up to your belief in that, 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 and the other. Mm-hmm. And particularly around the idea of atonement and sort of this punitive thing that we have to overcome. That blends into not only atonement theories, but also Christology and trying to wear the hat of theologian and then feeling like, you know, God, it's
having to speak for all of Christendom.
Right. Well, and I thought about it on the way up and I was like, yeah, but I pretty much do that to you every podcast. Cause it's like, please speak for all of Judaism, time immortal. And I was like, why am I getting upset?
Yeah, at least I've got a reference. It's called Talmud. So.
Right. Well, we just don't have a nice convenient one book, shitloads of commentary. Some of them, mm-hmm. reasonably good. And I felt put in the role of an apologist, which, and I'm sitting there thinking, like, this isn't what Charles isn't goading me.
I was going to say,
that's just,
at first, let me say that of course was never my intent.
No.
And you know, that's, I guess, one of the things we got to revisit. But it is one of the difficulties, I think, in just interfaith conversations to begin with, and for those of you who don't follow it, you need to follow Interfaith Chat on Twitter.
Dr. Meredith Gould.
Meredith Gould moderates, and one of the common topics is what are some of the barriers, and a number of people say it's just a natural defensiveness
right.
when and entering into any of these conversations.
And I got my hackles up, and I couldn't tell you why at that time. Mm-hmm. And I think, first of all, with the Interfaith, and we'll be on the GooseCast stage. And
yes, we will.
Is that one of the statements I made is I underestimated that we had, or overestimated that we had a common language. Because, you know, as you already said, you know, grace is just not a Jewish thing, at least not as it exists in Christianity. And then we got into the whole discussion of the historical Jesus and the early church and how much of this is trying to, in its own right, be an apologetic. You know, why do we have to have a, you know, son of God that's actually a blood relative of God or something to that effect? And so I was like, why am I getting pissed off? Because I generally am pretty progressive and you know, the type of work I do, I don't spend a lot of time doing apologetics, and I've never had to do it with you. You know, and so it was this, why am I getting so defensive? Why am I putting on this, I'm the pastor of the church and I've got to defend the faith and et cetera, et cetera, when no, you know, there was no attack being made. And so part of it is, and we were talking before we started recording. In fact, we got, like we usually do, we started talking.
And
we
said, the best parts of the podcast have not been recorded.
Trust us. If you think the podcast is good, which, you know, you probably don't. But it was this feeling of I associate my faith with my illness. And to kind of clarify that is, no, I do not believe. Right. I'm not actually going to pull back again. I don't believe the church made me sick. I don't. But I do think the environment that churches place on ministers, and I can say that across Christendom, doesn't really promote good health. I mean, and you ask any actuary, and there's the Duke Clergy Health Initiative will back this up, and it's kind of a longitudinal study of clergy health, is before interventions were made, it was, you'd have to be a nut job as an actuary to give us insurance. You know, and you know, again, that's only capturing a very small sample. So where I associate my faith with my illness is when I was at my sickest, and not surprisingly, I turned to God. I mean, that, you know, that's the no atheist in foxholes kind of move. Although I don't think I was waiting until I was under fire to have faith. I had it before. But when, you know, you're trying to find a reason not to kill yourself, you know.
Any port in a storm.
Even if it was, I'm not going to kill myself because you're going to, you know, send me to hell. So where I think I associate with my illness was, one, the church as an environment for me at some point became toxic. And that's not on any one church. That's not on any one person I've ever cared for. You know, and I'm taking that on me as, you know, there were boundary issues I had, and not in the sense of sleeping with the laity or anything like that, but saying no and, you know, logging off and calling it quits each day, you know, that kind of stuff. Those kind of boundaries. So the part where I associate it with more beyond like an institution is, you know, people, well-meaning people of faith, you know, we've covered this before, said, you know, just keep getting the word, you know, pray harder, you know, do something, you know, as if you can move God. And then the second thing was that people that were really there at the very end before I had my, you know, my final breakdown, or to date my final breakdown, and then, you know, the 2 months inpatient and ECT for a year, you know, when I called for help, they were all about praying for me and hugging on me and that sort of stuff, but not one person had the presence of mind to take me to the hospital. And then also in that deluded sort of psychotic mind, I thought, you know, I've shared this on the podcast, that every time I walked into my church that I was serving at that time, I felt sick. And because I was surrounded by very spiritual people, they interpreted through the lens of faith and said, oh, well, it's demonic possession. The devil's after you, which I've since then been able to go that doesn't make sense either strategically. Because, I mean, what's the point? There's no gain for the prince of darkness. And I didn't have one person to say, maybe you just hate working here. It's not you know, other people have enjoyed working there. Not for you, which most folks would have said, it's not a good match.
Any other job. In any other industry, that's what the response would have been.
Right. And I think it would have been even if it wasn't, you know, parish-based. But when you associate your calling with your vocation and you feel that walking away is walking away from God, and that's how I felt, I couldn't approach church work. I still can't do it as it's just a job. But that's part of my faith and my passion for it. But I associate it with my illness now. And so I find myself, when I feel close to God, and that's where I got frustrated, because I couldn't explain myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I was like going, you know, for a kid that grew up abused and neglected to a degree, having a heavenly Father that loves me and is not judging me is super awesome. Having a God that became human and knows what it's like to experience, you know, my own Garden of Gethsemane. You know, please, God, just let this pass. Please just make me well. Mm-hmm. You know, I had not had the conversation with my other Jew to say, look, well, if you're praying to win the lottery, you should probably go out and buy a ticket.
Yeah, buy a ticket.
Which is a wonderfully Jewish thought that sadly is passed over in the people I had contact with. And these were good people. I'm not judging them. But so that's where my faith was at. And so now I'll have moments where I'm in worship, and it's usually the music. It's usually the music. And sometimes it's those real genuine moments when, you know, whoever's giving the sermon doesn't necessarily go off script, but you can tell because you write sermons, you automatically become a good critiquer of them. And so you notice when they're no longer doing the sort of exegetical academic stuff and they've veered into the art. And it's not especially when it's not a manipulative art, when it's just the beauty of the turn of phrase and how they work the room. And anyway, and it's in hearing people just share, you know, what they've witnessed in the past week. You know, I was terrified that the cancer diagnosis is going to come back positive. It's not. And just seeing the joy on their face. Mm-hmm. And I catch myself going into this moment of, oh, isn't God wonderful? And then I'm brought back to the night, well, it was more than one night, when I was inpatient screaming, which many of the nurses could tell you, you know, for God to do something, and nothing happened. Mm-hmm. I was describing it. As you know, I like to use the image of the Holy Triduum, the Paschal Triduum, the good. Well, it includes Maundy Thursday, but I'm using it in the sense of Good Friday, Easter, Holy Saturday, and Easter Sunday. So death, loss on Good Friday, resurrection, new life, new normal, Easter Sunday. I'm on Holy Saturday in a way with my faith, and there are times I go back to Friday, and there's times I jump forward to Sunday. But it's sort of this. It's not ambivalence, I think. It's just, this is where I'm at. And I believe something good's going to come out of that. But being caught on Saturday last time we recorded pissed me off. And my own anger, I think, is more with me. So that's where I was at. I've talked enough. Right. I'm going to be quiet and drink some Virgil Caine and smoke my LFD Cabinet 5.
LFD Cabinet 5. Okay. This sort of raises a few things in my mind of, and I hate this, the phrase, you know, you have to love yourself before someone will love you, because, you know, what does your esteem have to do with your lovability? But that's a whole other thing. But it does sort of,
it makes practical sense.
Yeah. And so what was kind of going through my mind is there room or space in the concept of grace to allow yourself some grace?
Right.
Yeah, because it seems that was part of what you were not doing. I'm not saying when you were sick. I'm saying since our last podcast, that those right. feelings being brought up and the reaction to it, you know, more so than just the cliched, you know, hey, just cut yourself a little slack. But seriously, in a sense, what I'm asking is, what is the human role in attaining grace, and how much of that? And I know that there are different views on that in different denominations, but generally, you know, trying to get away from the extreme of, oh, you have to be good in order for God to love you, or the other extreme of the elect. So more in the middle there, what is the role? Is there a role? How does just human activity play? play in how Grace has worked out.
I think some of it is, I don't want to be a pastor anymore. That doesn't mean I don't want to be a minister, but I sometimes envy the laity of being able to say, fuck it. Because I feel this sort of call to defend the faith or represent the faith. And it's representing in the call that I'm feeling to defend, God's not asked me to do that. In fact, I think that moments when I do that, I become the least convincing. And, you know, if I'm going to convert, to use that word, somebody, it's not going to be in those moments. We've identified that. Apologists don't win souls, to use that language.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't have that. I don't feel I have the grace to give myself that I can exist in doubt. And the other part is more on a personal level is, you know, when you're working with people, you know, family, friends as well, and, you know, they're going through a tough spot and they're like, you know, they're legitimately and with full faith, you know, relying on God and that's working for them. There's that part of me that, you know, I'm very tactful. I don't go in there and spoil that with my sort of theodicies and whatnot. I have the reaction of, I have no idea how to respond to you because every muscle in my body is wanting to say it's fiction or it doesn't work that way or hasn't worked that way for me. And then there's a part where I'm like, ignorance is bliss and I wish I could be ignorant again. You know, I took the wrong pill, man. Mm-hmm. You know, I made the mistake of looking away from the cave wall. You know, but even then, I mean, it's very critical and I think very elitist and snobby. I don't know. At least those are the words that come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Virgil Caine break.
I'm trying to pull it out from the personal experience.
Right, because you also deal with depression.
Which is tough to do.
Deal with depression.
Yeah. And that's the hardest thing is to cut yourself a little slack and do that. But it's why I think we brought up the whole topic to begin with on our last podcast is it is a, and correct me if I'm wrong, a central tenet of Christianity that there is this thing called grace.
Yeah.
But it has no corollary in Judaism.
I suspect it does, but it's at least not, some sort of proto we grew out of. Is it a complete invention for Christianity?
I don't know. I mean, there's parts of it, but there's nothing in Torah that I know of, and I admit I'm not the greatest Torah scholar.
For all Jews, like I can't speak and for all Christians.
I mean, in all the education I've ever received and all the people I've talked to and classes and lectures, other than using the word in its meaning for, you know, a beautiful physical movement, grace does not come up. The word is never said in any theological setting in talking about Judaism.
So what if we just abandon the language for a moment?
But it's not the language. It's that's what I'm saying. The concept itself of of being saved.
Right. Again, now
that's
well, you have a national identity. I mean, the Goel.
Well, it's difficult, and because there's a certain Hellenistic component to taking the very real worldly political idea of Mashiach in Judaism and moving it from a real life, flesh and blood, national savior.
Between the community versus the individual in the West.
Right. Well, I said, but it's an actual real person who will come and, defeat our oppressors and restore Israel. It's not a metaphysical one.
Did Christianity make ourselves the oppressor of ourself?
Well, that's what the
that may first, be sidetracking.
There's two things that, well, no, because there's two things that are happening there. And I think that you're asking a legitimate question because there's two things that are happening there. The first is the attention on the individual separated out from the community and the national condition. And there's some hints of that. Isaiah, Hosea start to talk, you know, separate the fate of the individual from the nation a bit. But it's done very sparingly. But that's a very Hellenistic view. And then the second one is that it went from being a hope for an actual political leader to a metaphysical savior.
Did Christianity, you think, picked up there and went a different direction, diverged?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Because I agree with you, the Hellenist influence is definitely...
Yeah,
definitely contributed to the individual focus over the
right.
community.
I mean, right. that's that is a Hellenistic idea.
Right.
I guess the question is how much of this is coming from, you know, Paul trying to balance what he had to put in the religion to keep the Jewish Christians, and also what he needed so that he could keep the Gentile Christians.
Well, it's Paul speak Greek to Greeks, Roman,
right.
Latin to Romans,
right.
Hebrew to
right.
Jews.
So is that part of where this shift happens?
I mean, he's got the bit where he talks about the shrine to the unknown God. I mean, you could label it as syncretism. You could label it as a number of things, but I think some of it is the benefit of interfaith relationships that aren't trying to either sort of, you know, make everybody, we all really kind of believe the same thing, but maybe mm-hmm. from slightly different angles, you know, and kind of existing yeah. in either that totally combative or totally over mm-hmm. identifying with one another, is that Jews are infinitely more capable of sitting with doubt, ambivalence. They can be
yeah.
pissed at God and not feel in the slightest bit.
It's built in. It's in the DNA.
That's perfectly okay, and you don't, yeah. and you're not upset. You can exist in a close relationship with God that is based on being pissed off,
mm-hmm.
and that doesn't invalidate the faith. Now, I have, even in my current line of work, said that to plenty of parishioners, plenty of patients, their families, but then when it comes back to it's bedtime and you're alone with your thoughts. Your personal experience at times speaks louder than your faith. And I don't know, that's maybe just a whole arbitrary kind of line drawn between the two. But, you know, again, like last week, I'm at a limit for language.
I think you're getting caught in a binary.
Good
chance.
And
I thought I taught you better than that.
I know.
Well, it sounds like you're creating the binary between your faith and your life. This is my lived experience,
and this
is my faith. And maybe that's the source of maybe you're feeling apologetic.
That's the holdover.
Is that you don't, right, is that...
Because as a pastor,
yeah,
and I will say this, and it'll probably offend some people, but, you know, fuck, is that...
Yeah, why stop it? Episode 66.
There's the public faith that pastors feel obligated or have to show, and there's the shit that their family sees after they've dealt... You know, it's like the old joke, like, why are preacher's kids so damned awful? Well, fuck, they have to play with the ladies' damn kids. Mm-hmm. But that's a very real example of how the public faith kills families, husbands, wives, children. So it does exist. That's not a fabrication or a Chris only experience.
No, but I'm not talking about your public faith. I'm talking about the difference between...
But I'm having two separate... One doesn't agree yeah. with the other. There,
yeah, but I think is not, because I heard it in the word you're using of, you know, it's all this with your faith, but then at night when you're alone with your lived experience, it doesn't match up. That's the binary, I think, that
it does.
You've gotten caught in that is causing some of that anger, because there seems to be a split between faith in the way you're living where that hadn't happened before.
And I wonder
where, if, you know, those were the same thing, but now you're feeling like, well, yeah, there's my faith and I do this and I say that and I can talk about this, but then also, but does it match with how I live? And that seems problematic.
No, it is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
I mean, so there's that public and private, and clergy don't have the, I think if clergy took the option, because I think one of the things that endeared me to people was that is my genuineness. And I'm like, you know, I can sit with them in ambivalence. I might go home and not sleep that night because I had to sit with it. And that's not on anybody I've ever cared for or will care for. That's my baggage. And I think part of it is I feel the need to hold on to a narrative that I no longer know how to tell. Like if you ask me, well, tell me about your conversion experience. I don't want to talk about it. You know, and part of it is, you know, I don't have to identify with that one moment for the rest of my life. I don't have to identify as the kid that grew up in these circumstances or dealing with that. I mean, I can choose all kinds of identities and still be me. But I can conceive of life now in a way that I didn't as a kid, which was, you know, I grew up, I was born, baptized Methodist, confirmed, ordained. I mean, I was as Methodist as you can get and still be conscious. And then, you know, it's the sort of thing, and this is not unusual to Christianity, is, you know, mom's a Christian, mom was a Christian, grandparents, you go to church is where you have your friends. You're so inundated that it becomes so much a part of your narrative that it's kind of ridiculous when we ask people to join the church that weren't believers, like somebody that came to faith, as they say, because you don't know how not to choose faith. Depression, on the other hand, said, you know what? You can get through this life. You can get through this world. You can make great contributions. You can be perfectly productive and happy. And God doesn't have to enter into the entire question narrative. God doesn't have to exist in that universe. But as a kid that grew up, Bible Belt, we were, you know, North Carolina with a fucking notch where the belt loop goes. I mean, you know, I don't know how to live in that life where I can now conceive of without. And I know with my own family, not so much with Mrs. Jew, Gentile. Well, Mrs. Jew didn't care either.
Yeah,
she's Jewish. She's like,
let's clarify that. No, you do not live with Mrs.
No.
Dr. Mrs. Jew, soon to be rabbi to you.
But it puts me at odds. You know, I'm really comfortable with chaplains because the majority of that I've known and over my career and in my current work, they're all cool with that. They get that. But you know, I haven't hung out with clergy, like church clergy, in so long that, you know, well, I'm infinitely less depressed, but that was when I was hurting so bad, was just be straight with me. Take the fucking hat off. I need to see what it looks like when you show the scars, the warts, I need that visceral, not the party line. I know how to say the party line. I know what you're supposed to say to me. I want you to say something totally disarming. Such as, you know what? I don't have a fucking answer for that.
I have to find a rabbi.
Well, I traded one Jew for another.
And I know it sounds like I'm like one upping, but it's not that.
I'm not hearing it that way for the record.
I know you're not, but our listeners might. But what it gets to is, again, another binary that I think you're struggling with that. And it's not just you. I think, again, this is what a lot of people struggle with, whether it's a mental health issue or not, but just in faith in general, is the difference between your faith and church.
No, you're right.
You know, and you know, when you put the emphasis on the institution.
The institution conveys the message.
Yeah, but it just conveys the message.
It isn't the message.
It isn't the message. And, you know, all due respect to, what's his name? And now my mind's going. It's the medication. In this case,
could be the Virgil King.
You know, the medium is not the message.
No.
Okay. And I think when people get those things.
So here's a bold thought.
Confused, that can create a big issue. Because then when you're, like you're saying, you know, with that, you know, associating your illness with your faith, but you're really associating it with the institution.
No, an institution, if we also include you know, family of origin too.
Yeah.
And I agree with that.
Yeah, because the emphasis was on the church, but not living a life of faith, but going to this church and being part of this church and this group out to the church.
But you also know how hard it is to break away from those early primary of narratives that we grow up with. I mean, that's ingrained.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. And that's how those things get so enmeshed and tied together that, you know, when you're having difficulty with one, it's hard to see that you're not really having difficulty with the other because they're almost the same thing.
Well, and part
so
of it,
hard that you can't separate them out.
I'm no longer employed by a church denomination. I'm no longer, I claim by denomination, they don't pay me anything anymore. And so that has given me some freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking about that, the vehicle, the medium through which a message is conveyed. And I've said on the podcast before.
I'm sorry, Marshall McLuhan. Thank you.
The medium and the vehicle, there are times when I'm doing the work I'm doing now, and I know this probably is going to border on overstatement, but it's still a truth, is that I'd ask the question, is the church still the best vehicle or medium to convey the message of God? And my gut feeling is no. Hasn't been for some time.
And that's a huge impetus in the Empty the Pews and ex-evangelical movements.
Well, and I'll come out behind the curtain, you know, as far as the you know, pay no attention to that man, is that sometimes it felt like I was keeping the show going. And it seems like, you know, I'm trying to tell people that, especially, you know, in churches where I've served, where the folks have been really poor, and I'm looking down at my salary and it's the largest line item. And the majority of my work is not missions, it's maintenance. And then when you try to push for mission and out action, your higher-ups, you know, your bill payers, your employers say, no, keep the customer satisfied. And so at some point, you kind of go back to Paul going like, you know, I can be a tent maker and do a whole lot more. And I remember that when I first, you know, set free of being pastor, not reverend, but pastor, is that you have this unique freedom where you can deal with people in meetings, and when they're out of line, you don't have to worry about, well, they pay for my housing, they pay for my... You can tell them to, in the words of St. Paul, fuck off. And I think that is a grace. You know, when you're afraid of bishops and superintendents, once you no longer employed or need employment from them, they have less authority than, you know, somebody that's checking me out in Walmart. Mm-hmm. It's like, fuck you. Yeah, you know, and I'm not ashamed of saying that. Mm-hmm.
But it's also an issue.
The institution,
you know, for the laity as well. When, you know, and we've seen case after case, and it's not limited to Christianity, and Judaism has the problem as well of, you know, pastors and leaders of religious institutions taking advantage of people, equating the institution and that person.
Oh, you prey upon their fears and emotions.
Yeah,
very much so. Yeah. No, it's there. Mm-hmm. And that's not to discredit. I know that's hard to say on the backside, but thinking of people that are genuinely called to that and they're doing, I know what it's like to be in those trenches. It's not that everybody, I go between trying to think of the folks that are trying to do the best with the team that they've got, the players they have, to use that metaphor. And yet at the same time, I have this, I don't know, I have two opinions on it. One is Augustine and one is Karl Marx. Augustine made this.
Yes.
So it's not much different now. Augustine made the statement, the church is your mother, but she's a whore. Right. Marx, from a different angle, points out religion is, and you thought we had an opioid problem now, the opiate of the masses. Mm-hmm. And I have experienced as a pastor, and if I want to really go back into it as a parishioner, if I had time to tell like my experience with the church growing up, you would actually ask, and people that ordained me actually ask, why are you still here? You know, because it was just that dysfunctional. Mm-hmm. And I looked at that, and I still do, as a genuine sense of I'm here for a reason. Mm-hmm. If for no other reason than to tell you that she's your mother, she's also a whore. And at some level, and I remember it, I had infinite more problems with with my laity when I said, I'm no longer going to deal drugs to you. I literally said that in a sermon. And I stopped. This is the reality we're dealing with. We're going to either enter it face on, or you can just bring somebody else in that can make you feel slightly better about yourselves for an hour each Sunday.
Unfortunately, it's what a lot of people want.
Well, and there's plenty of people lining up to give it to them. And I think clergy, we fool ourselves with all, you know, we talk about like all the church growth and how do we get the millennials in. It's the same shit we were saying back in the early part of the century. But
how do we get the Xers in? How do we get the boomers in?
Right. It's the same fucking question. It not even creatively repackaged it. Now, I knew that coming in, and my first appointment in the U.S. was 2003. And I remember dealing with youth ministers and pastors that were like, we're going to figure out how to reach these postmodern people. And now it's postmodern. It's become millennial. Before it was postmodern, was popular, definitely the Xers. Mm-hmm. And so what is the big question that church growth folks ask is, why aren't the kids coming back? Because previously, you know, I do my college shit, I get my wild oats sowed and all that shit. And then when I have kids, the trend was, go back to church.
Right.
And so within that, even from a sociological point of view, is something quit. Or something that was never working finally got to the point people are like, probably in the same place I am right now going, you know, I can do all these wonderfully good things. I can even do it in the name of God. I don't have to do it in your building and your institution.
Right. And that's the...
Jesus.
You know, the threat the millennials have. But that's the question. You can go back. I mean, that was the question Paul was trying to answer. You know, how do I get the Jewish Christians in? How do I get the Gentiles in? How do I grow this thing?
The historian in me wants to say that. I don't know if you can use Jewish Christian with the time of Paul.
Well,
sort of an ambivalence. I don't think they had a name.
That's I'm saying in identifying.
I imagine Paul's playing
Jews who were followers of Christ.
I think Paul, if we take Paul at what he's said to be, his education, his grooming, there's still a point where you have to go, shit. Other people that weren't Jewish started getting into the message.
Right.
And those were
the Gentiles.
Right.
But I'm saying, so he's like, how do we keep the Jews, but how do we also add the Gentiles? How do we get them in? Well, in a gesture of grace.
Right.
To our listener.
Oh, fuck yeah. All seven of them.
Yeah.
We had
especially
eight
the ones
beginning,
in,
but
the,
one,
the ones in Sri Lanka.
We love you.
Yeah.
Have your country import Virgil Caine.
So we're going to, or invite us and we'll bring it. We're going to end with some words of wisdom.
Well, we should have some at some point.
And for no particular reason.
As usual.
This is a quote from Grace Slick.
Oh, so we're going back to Grace. I was expecting.
We got.
You've gone
full circle here.
It was like an hour now. You haven't mentioned Rambam, Buber. You've been.
Well, this is from the great philosopher Grace Slick.
One pill makes you matter. That's
Go
a
ask
fucking
Alice.
Great song.
Go ask Alice.
Of things she'll know.
Yeah.
Logic and proportion. It's not as funny as when we did Monty Python.
Yeah, it was much better.
That was better. And I was like, and I didn't even see that. I was going like, nobody expects a Spanish Inquisition.
How did you not see that? Well, of course you didn't see it coming because no one expects it.
Well, I went with Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
I was more Semitic.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyway, so Grace Slick once said, no matter how big or soft or warm your bed is, you still have to get out of it.
Well, I'm Chris Henson, and I'm still the Gentile.
And I'm Charles Breton, and I'm still the Jew.
Join us on our next episode, where you can listen to a Jew and a Gentile walk into a bar mitzvah.
Special thanks to Ethan Sapphire for letting us use his song Shoulda Woulda Coulda as our theme. You can download Ethan's music at soundclick.com/Ethan Sapphire.
Shoulda, woulda, coulda, but I didn't, that's for real. You can't get back the hand.